from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A new report suggests that the number of deaths due to preventable accidents in American hospitals may be twice the previous estimate, almost 200,000 a year. Experts disagree on the numbers, but whether it's 100,000 or 200,000 or more, human error in the hospital is a major American killer. Tonight on Point, death by hospital. Allegations of an epidemic of deadly mistakes in America's centers of health care. But first, a U.S. Army hearing continues today to determine whether Private First Class Lindy England will be court-martialed. Private England was front and center among Army reservists, smiling for the camera while Iraqi detainees were forced into humiliating sexual positions at the now infamous Abu Ghraib prison outside Baghdad. Ari Shapiro is covering the story for NPR. He joins us from Fort Bragg, North Carolina. Ari, thanks for being with us.
It's my pleasure, Tom.
Ari, take us into the hearing room today. What was the scene there?
Well, actually, all nine of the witnesses who testified today were testifying by the phone. And so the scene was pretty much a few lawyers for the prosecution, all in military fatigues, a few defense lawyers, one of whom was also a military lawyer. Lindy England was there. Her mother, who attended the hearing yesterday, did not appear to be there today. And then there was the investigating officer who presided as judge. And the nine witnesses all spoke for the prosecution. Some of them called in from Virginia. Others were phoned in Iraq. And they all sort of testified as to what happened at Abu Ghraib when Lindy England was there and the scenario surrounding the alleged abuse.
And what is at stake in the hearings this week, Ari?
Well, the hearing is going to be used to decide, first of all, whether Lindy England will face a court-martial for the 19 charges that are currently against her. If so, what kind of a court-martial? There are three different types of court-martials she could face. And then finally, which of the 19 counts that she's faced with she will be tried on. There are 13 of those counts that are directly related to detainee abuse. And then there are six other counts unrelated to detainee abuse, and those relate to some explicit photographs of Lindy England with another soldier, Specialist Charles Grainer.
Now, Lindy England is one of six reserve soldiers facing possible court-martial. A seventh has already pleaded guilty. What about the others? Do their fates depend on what happens here? Is this setting a precedent?
You know, there's sort of this cumulative effect where in each Article 32 hearing, which is what today's hearing is called, similar people testify and more pieces of the puzzle sort of get filled in. So, for example, at today's testimony, we heard this very graphic description of abuse that had actually already sort of come out in some of the earlier Article 32 hearings. So there are overlaps, but they're certainly not the same, and one is not necessarily entirely dependent on another. For example, Specialist Charles Grainer, who I mentioned earlier, had his Article 32 hearing in Iraq last month, and at this hearing, Grainer is sort of being portrayed as the instigator of the abuse, whereas at the last hearing, of course, the defense was trying to prove that he was not responsible at all.
Is there any question that Lindy England will proceed to court-martial hearings after everything we've seen and heard from Abu Ghraib?
You know, I think it would be hard to imagine, given all of the evidence against her right now, that she would not go to a hearing. That said, the investigating officer seems to be very invested in making sure that no one could say Lindy England did not have a fair trial. She seems to be allowing the defense lawyers plenty of time to cross-examine all of the witnesses, allowing more than 20 witnesses to be called, which is far more than we've had in any of the other Article 32 hearings so far. So while it does seem almost inevitable that Lindy England will eventually go to a court-martial, this hearing is definitely going through all of the formalities necessary to make sure that's a just decision.
Lindy England is now 7 months pregnant, we're told. She's sitting there in Army fatigues. I guess she got pregnant during her time in Iraq, and that may be part of what's alleged here, the scenes that were photographed of her in sexual relations. What kind of material has come out as the Army criminal investigators have made their testimony, Ari?
Well, the first witness to testify today actually spoke directly to those pictures that led to the six new counts. That witness was Specialist Stephen Strother, and he testified as to a vacation, actually, that he took with Private Lindy England and Specialist Charles Grainer, who England's lawyers say is the father of her child. Her baby boy is due in October. And in his testimony, he described going on this vacation in which England and Grainer swam naked, took naked pictures with each other, and then after the witness apparently passed out from drinking too much, they took photos of themselves naked with the witness, which, you know, for civilians would not be a crime, but in military circumstances, clearly it is.
And what about Lindy England's part in the abuse inside Abu Ghraib prison?
Well, there was a lot of testimony surrounding that today. The prosecution seems to be trying to show that she was a willful participant, that she had no reason to be in the site in Abu Ghraib where the abuse took place other than just to socialize and to spend time with Specialist Grainer, whereas the defense is trying to show that she was told to be there, she was instructed to pose for these photographs, and that she is, you know, a young, untrained prison guard who is just sort of being used as a scapegoat here.
Of course, it looks pretty bad in the pictures. The Army folks testifying, making the case that this is a rogue soldier among rogue soldiers. Her defense attorney, Richard Hernandez, blasting the government for holding rank-and-file soldiers accountable for what he called a systematic problem in Iraq. He said it was far from truth that interrogators and senior officers were not aware of what was happening there. Who seems to be making the stronger case on that front, Ari?
Well, because of the structure of the trial, where the prosecution is allowed to call witnesses first, we've really only heard the defense's case and the defense's cross-examination of the witnesses. And so far, they seem to be focusing intently on the role of military intelligence, the interrogation procedures that may have been in effect or that may not have been entirely clear. But since the witnesses who have been called so far have been entirely for the prosecution's case at the moment, of course, seems to be rather strong.
Colonel Denise Arne will decide whether this goes forward to court-martial and on what charges. When is that decision likely to come down?
Well, the hearing is scheduled to last through Friday. They said they could extend it through the weekend if necessary, but it looks as though they're on track to finish by the end of the day on Friday. And at that point, Colonel Arne can take whatever time she wants to reach a decision. And then she'll make her announcement all in due time, I suppose.
A hard week for Private Linda England. Ari Shapiro, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure.
Ari Shapiro is a reporter for National Public Radio. He spoke with me from Fort Bragg, North Carolina. Everyone makes an occasional mistake at work. In hospitals, those mistakes can kill. Stories of a friend who died because of human error in a hospital bed are spine tinglers, and it turns out all too common. There's a range of estimates of the total number annually. None are small. One new study suggests 200,000 deaths a year. If that's true, hospital error is the sixth leading cause of death in America. Whatever the number, observers agree that the hospital death toll, death by error, is somewhere between too many and way too many. And in an election year when medical malpractice issues are on the table, that means it's a campaign issue as well. This hour on Point, death by hospital, by mistake, by the thousands. What's your fear factor when you head through the hospital doors? Is it too high? Is it too low? And what will it take to ensure a reasonable margin of error in the nation's hospitals? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Denver, Colorado, is Dr. Blaine Schilling, senior consultant at HealthGrades, the medical rankings group that published the new report last week. Good evening and welcome, Dr. Blaine Schilling.
Hey, it's good to be here.
Thanks for joining us. So give us your findings. 200,000 is the number that hit the headlines. 200,000 what?
Well, those are 200,000 lives that, based on our study, may have died because of some kind of medical error or a failure to act in an appropriate time period in order to prevent that death.
In American hospitals in 1 year?
Actually, yes. The number that we came up with was 575,000 over the three-year period. So, yeah, approximately 195,000 to 200,000 a year.
And how did you perform your research?
Well, what HealthGrades did is applied sort of a broad administrative database. We use what's called the MedPAR database, or the billing information from all of the Medicare recipients for that three-year period. And we're talking about the time period of 2000 to 2002.
Okay.
So we took that administrative information and applied it to the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality's software to calculate numbers of patient errors or medical errors.
And out of that, you got the number of 575,000 over these years, or about 200,000 a year. And what kind of mistakes were you tracking in the survey?
Yeah. Well, we utilized the AHRQ's patient safety indicators. They have 20 of those. Now, four of those apply to obstetrics cases. And since we're only talking about the Medicare population, naturally the obstetrics cases didn't apply. So we then narrowed it down to the 16. Here we're talking about issues of decubitus ulcer, which would be developing a bed sore because you're in the hospital.
And dying from that?
Many people did. But that in itself would have been a preventable error, which, although it may not have caused death, may have caused additional length of stay in the hospital, additional cost to that hospital, and eventually additional cost in terms of taking care of these people.
And what other errors?
Well, post-operative infections, post-operative blood clots in the leg that may have been gone to the lungs and have caused death. We looked at if a foreign body was left. You know, that's one of the most egregious things you can think of. Someone left a clamp or something in somebody. We looked at those as well. We looked at whether or not you developed, after having an operation, something happened in your post-operative care and you may not have been followed well enough, so you fell and may have had a fracture of your hip. We looked at whether or not you had bleeding after surgery, whether or not you had metabolic things with electrolytes and metabolic derangements after surgery.
And what's the picture that came out of all this? Are you describing an American hospital system that's, you know, calamitously given to error, or something less alarming than that?
Well, I think it's best said that the numbers here are based on the software are preventable errors. So, I mean, some people may argue that if these are preventable errors, that one is too many. But we found on, you know, a large number, way more than anybody would anticipate, and many of these errors resulted in death.
Is it fair to make your extrapolations off of Medicare cases? Are those cases that are worse than average, more likely to die than average, went to the hospital to die in effect?
Well, you know, that is a reasonable thing to consider. But the patient safety database that we looked at on using the software that AHRQ developed, it was designed to weed out those patients that went to the hospital to die. They weeded out those patients that were too sick and someone expected to die. For example, in one of our highest mortality areas, the failure to rescue indicator, it took out anybody over the age of 75.
What is failure to rescue? That was a very big factor in your big number.
Absolutely. Failure to rescue is defined as patients who developed a complication after being in the hospital. The underlying assumption is that good hospitals would identify these complications quickly, treat them aggressively, and prevent the death from the complication.
And you're saying if that didn't happen, and should have, then they died, and that's part of your number. You're vice president of medical affairs and others there. Have used some pretty strong language to illustrate what's being described here. This is Samantha Collier, Dr. Samantha Collier,
yes,
describing this as the equivalent of 390 jumbo jets full of people dying each year due to likely preventable in-hospital medical errors. She calls this one of the leading killers in the United States. Your company has a hospital ranking service.
Yes.
That's your major business, right?
That's correct.
And presumably, if there is a significant public fear of dying in the hospital, that those rankings become more valuable, more important. Is this marketing to pump up your core business? Are you at risk of being seen as exaggerating a death by hospital error for your own bottom line?
Well, you know, the goal of our hospital, or the mission, the mission of our organization is to improve the quality of care nationwide. All we've done is taken an administrative database that many people have, applied it to a software system that everybody can have access to, and have come up with numbers that seem to be surprising people. I don't see any self-serving goals behind trying to improve the quality of care nationwide.
And yet it might work for your business.
You know, if that were to happen, then we would be pleased, of course. But at the same time, we want to consider the fact that, I mean, frankly, we were all surprised. I honestly looked at these numbers and found them very incredible to imagine that many people dying.
Blaine Schilling, should Americans be afraid when they walk through the hospital doors, climb into a hospital bed?
I believe that Americans should use this information to arm themselves, just like they would if they were preparing to buy a car or preparing to buy some major purchase, to find out what they can. In other words, check out that hospital before you check in. Find out what their rates of mortality in these specific areas are. Find out what their rates of mortality and outcomes and complications are in many major procedures. Mm. And check that out before you check in.
Blaine Schilling, stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight about death by hospital error. allegations of an epidemic of deadly mistakes in America's centers of healthcare. We're going to come back and test these numbers, see what's going on in those hospitals. Can you imagine 200,000 Americans dying each year because of mistakes, errors in the hospital? Does an epidemic of hospital errors square with your expectations of what happens beyond the admissions desk? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about death by hospital error, allegations of an epidemic of deadly mistakes in America's centers of health care. A new report out last week saying 200,000, nearly 200,000 Americans a year dying because of mistakes in the hospital. Can you understand how things might go wrong even in healthcare's core institutions? Can you understand how they might go wrong at that scale? And what's your fear factor when you head through the hospital doors? Is it too high? Is it too low? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I've been joined from Denver, Colorado by Dr. Blaine Schilling, senior consultant at HealthGrades, which produced the report on deaths due to hospital error that came out last week. And now joined from Newfane, Vermont by Lucian Leap. He's an adjunct professor of health policy at Harvard's School of Public Health. He co-authored a 1999 report for the Institute of Medicine, estimating that roughly 95,000 patients die each year due to hospital error. Lucian Leap, thanks for joining us tonight.
It's a pleasure to be here, Tom.
So a lot to go through with you here, but let's just look first. In 99, when you came out with this number of nearly 100,000, you took a lot of flack for that. People said it might be too high. You said it might be too low. Now HealthGrades is coming out with a number of 200,000. What do you think of that number? Do we have a problem here?
Well, I have trouble with that number because of the way it was determined. I think you made the important point, whether it's 50,000 or 100,000 or 200,000 is too many. And we need to get beyond the numbers. But I do think this study has some significant problems, so I'm not quite ready to accept that.
Problems such as?
Well, I think they're in two areas. Just go back a little bit. Everybody wants to figure out how to measure these things. I mean, it's a serious problem. How bad is it? How do we know if we're getting better? And what we've done in the past is to review medical records, and that's very expensive. Or some people have watched other people and see what mistakes they make. That's really expensive. If you have a computerized patient record, you can set up computer programs, but most hospitals don't have that. And so what HealthGrades has done is what a lot of people have been interested in, and that is looking at administrative data to see if they can figure out what's going on.
Right.
But I have three problems with that. The first is they've used this new indicator, failure to rescue. This is a relatively new concept. It's not been tested very much. It was developed as part of a study of nursing care.
And can you give us some practical illustrations of a kind of circumstance that might include?
Yeah, the definition of failure to rescue, the Agency for Health Research and Quality has spelled this out quite clearly, is that it refers to a patient who has any one of six conditions, pneumonia, shock, cardiac arrest, bleeding from the intestinal tract, infection, or blood clots.
Okay.
And the studies have shown, there's only a few studies that have used this, the studies that have done it have looked at whether patients with these conditions are more likely or less likely to die if they're cared for by registered nurses as opposed to other nurses, or
right,
if they're trained and cared by nurses with baccalaureate degrees.
Yep.
And what they've shown is that they do better when the nurses are better trained. Now, those studies have not established or attempted to define what the correct survival rate is. And the very critical point here is that many of these patients that have pneumonia or cardiac arrest or bleeding will die even if they have impeccable care.
And you're saying this new study has folded all of them into these numbers as though they're failures. They may not be failures. On the other hand, if I am in shock or have cardiac arrest, it sounds like a mistake if there's a failure to rescue, a failure to deal with me with that in time.
Well, that's the hypothesis. But the assumption there is that we can save all of them, which isn't true. And so what they have done, if you read their report and look at Appendix F, you see that they have said that if you have this condition and die, they attribute 100% of the deaths to that condition and say those are preventable. And there's no physician, no nurse who would agree with that at all. What we're saying is we can improve the mortality of these. We should be able to do, with good care, we can save many of them, but many of them we cannot save. I would propose that most of them that have these conditions can't be saved. Let me give an example. pneumonia. Pneumonia includes, let me step back. These are based on what's known as administrative data. Administrative data consists of a discharge diagnostic code that is put on a patient's record at the time of discharge by a clerk in the medical records room. They look through the record and they say, what did this patient have? And so it is a they assign a name to it. Now, the diagnosis pneumonia would be assigned to a healthy 25-year-old who had pneumonia and a condition which is rarely fatal, but it would also be assigned to a person who's an elderly patient with stroke and heart disease and diabetes. They might be at the very end of an uncorrectable course, and pneumonia is the final episode.
So you're saying we could pull those numbers out, but even if the failure to rescue numbers are pulled out, we've still got a very big number here at the 100,000 level or more, and the assertion here is that it's costing American hospitals, Americans, $19 billion a year to deal with these errors. You're not arguing with the assertion that there's a big, big problem here.
Not at all, but it is very important to recognize that this failure to rescue category, which is very dubious, accounts for 75% of the deaths in this study. So if you took them all out, their finding would be 50,000, not 200,000. So it is really very relevant, and also they have extrapolated from the Medicare population to the entire population, and you can't do that because Medicare patients are sicker, they have more complications, and a number of studies have showed that. So I think there's some methodologic problems here that really obfuscate the issue. I'm back to what you said at the beginning, which I agree with completely, and that is whether it's 50,000 or 200,000 is too many, and what we really need to do is to get off the numbers and talk about what are the issues here and what are we doing to improve patient safety, and I think that's what I'd like to talk about.
We will do exactly that, but Blaine Schilling, your numbers are challenged. I want to let you respond to that first. Do we have an inflated picture here of death by error in the hospital, or are you going to stand up and defend that number?
Well, I tend to believe that the numbers are accurate, that we did have this number of deaths. Now, I will agree that there is an extrapolation, but if you're going to extrapolate the numbers, then if you're going to disagree with the extrapolation of the numbers, then you're suggesting that there are two levels of care, or actually two standards of care, being applied to American patients based upon their payer status. And I certainly don't want to believe that that's happening. So if the same standard of care is applied, then I think the extrapolation of the numbers is truly accurate. As to the issue on the failure to rescue piece, I think Dr. Leap is exactly correct on the fact that much of what happens here is related to processes of care that can be improved. And whether or not all of these people can be saved remains to be seen, but unless we actually examine all 200,000 of these people, or in this case, the 150,000 with the failure to rescue, unless we examine them, we don't know how many we can save. When we have these ideas of that many of these people may have been left and came to the hospital to die, but we don't know that until we actually look at this data, examine the processes, and see if there is any move to improve.
I'm going to pull up the numbers argument right there. It is clear that you've got the debate or the issue front and center again, Blaine Schilling, wherever the right number is in this range. We appreciate your being with us tonight. Thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely.
Blaine Schilling, Dr. Blaine Schilling, is a senior consultant at HealthGrades, the group in Denver, Colorado, that produced the new report on hospital error deaths last week. Lucian Leap is with us. Dr. Lucian Leap, I want to turn now to Dr. Greg Meyer, who's joining us from Boston. He's medical director of the Massachusetts General Physicians Organization. It's the largest physicians group in New England with over 1,200 members. Greg Meyer, thanks for joining us tonight.
Good evening. Pleasure to be here.
So you can imagine for listeners, whether the number is 50,000 a year or 200,000 a year, the idea that a substantial number of Americans are checking into a hospital for health problems, large or small, and coming out dead is pretty unsettling. What's going on here?
Well, I think first to respond to the study a bit, I agree completely with Dr. Leap, and I think there are three conclusions that I think it's important for your listeners to understand. I think the first is the science of measuring this is really not there yet. I'm not convinced that this study necessarily advances that science, but regardless of that, I think the initial point here is that the science here needs some more work. With that said, the second point I think is enormously important. Everybody has agreed with you, and that is that this is all too common. There are too many, and we need to get to work now. And we can spend more time arguing over the numbers, and that's been done in the professional literature since the publication of the report that Dr. Leap contributed to. But the bottom line of it is that we need to get to work. And the argument about the numbers is something that can go off on a sideline, but we need to work today. And the third piece is that the way that we're going to move forward is we're going to put systems in place that keep patients safer. And those are the three conclusions that it's difficult, right, I think, to find anyone who's really gotten into the patient safety movement who wouldn't agree with those. And the truth of the matter is that's all we need to move forward. I think as far as your listeners are concerned, I think there is a balance here, and I think that there should be two approaches. I think the first one is to recognize, you know, that healthcare is not as safe as we all want it to be, and I assure you that sentiment runs through the provider community, runs through doctors and nurses and technicians and administrators at hospitals and in health systems and healthcare organizations around the country quite strong. We want to do this better. We want to be safer. And I think the important thing for your patients and your listeners to know is that there are things that they can do to help us in that effort.
Such as?
Well, one of the best sources I recommend for patients, and I use this with all of my own patients as a practicing internist, and we use it in our hospital and around our organization, is something called 5 Steps to Safer Healthcare. It's a simple document. Your patients can get access to it. It's on the website of the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, AHRQ, the group that developed those indicators that was talked about by the guest a bit earlier.
But I'm in the hospital. I don't have the internet. I'm lying in a hospital bed. I'm in a Johnny robe. I feel vulnerable. I'm counting on the staff
things.
Around me to help me. How am I supposed to feel safe if people are going out, accidentally mortality figures?
Yep. I think the first thing for patients to do is to recognize that, number one, is that they're an important part of this and they can help us along this effort. And there are some simple things that I would ask your listeners to do. The first one is ask questions that your physicians, the nurses, everyone else responsible for your care, you need to engage in that care. You need to understand what's going on. Ask questions if you have any doubts or concerns. The second thing is extraordinarily important, and this applies to when you're in the hospital or, more importantly and more often, when you're going to an outpatient visit, keep and bring a list of medications with you at all times. Have that a list of the medicines that you take and the supplements that you take, not just the things that you get prescribed to you, but those that you get from the health food store and those that you get at the pharmacy and elsewhere. And when you go to the doctor's office, bring it in a brown bag so everybody knows what you're really taking. The third thing is that I think we need to change the way that physicians and patients interact around the results of tests and procedures, and that is that in the past, the common notion was no news is good news. And I think what we all need to realize now is that we need to make sure that we know the results of our tests and procedures, and your providers should be giving that to you. The fourth thing is when you have a healthcare problem, talk to your doctor. Ask them which hospital, which kind of care really seems to best for your needs, and make sure that it fits into not just your medical needs, but your social needs and the needs of your families and others.
Right.
And then finally,
yeah,
if you need surgery or if you need a procedure, make sure that you understand exactly what's going to happen and what you need to do to take care of yourself and prepare for that. Now, this isn't all to say that this is the patient's job. This is a job for patients. It's a job for healthcare providers. This is a job for the greater society. And the truth of the matter is we all have roles here, but I think if we all work together and start to do some of these simple things,
yep,
it can make a huge difference.
We've got it. Greg Meyer, we've got it. Lucian Leap, that sounds like a tall order for patients in the hospital to keep on top of that. I think an awful lot of patients think, well, I'm here to be in the hands of professionals. They'll do what they need to do, not kill me.
Absolutely, and I don't think there's anybody in a hospital or any physicians that would disagree that patient safety is our responsibility. What Greg is saying is that patients can play a role, and what we have to do is give them a better role to play, but the bottom line is the responsibility is ours. I think there's a point here, Tom, that's worth making, particularly for your listeners, and that is this whole patient safety movement is very new. It really started just a bit before the IOM report, and it's based on a very different concept. And that is, before the movement, we used to say that that safety depended on having highly trained people, good people, and make sure they do things right.
Right.
When they don't do it right, you punish them.
Yep.
And what the new movement says is, you know, that's what got us where we are. That's not good enough. And we've turned to other industries and cognitive psychology and so forth, which have shown that people make mistakes for reasons. And the reasons are that they're working in systems that set them up to make a mistake. Two drugs that have similar names are going to get mixed up.
Right.
If you have somebody work for 24 hours without sleep, you know he's going to make more mistakes. And so what the movement says is if you want to reduce errors, you've got to change the system. Some of them are simple systems like drug names. Some are not so simple like getting different hours for doctors. Some are even more complicated, like teaching people to work better in teams. Others are technological solutions like computerized ordering and so forth.
But we know systems are famously resistant to change. Lucian Leap, I want to begin to get some callers in here, if you'll allow me. Steve is calling from Brookline, Massachusetts. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Oh, Tom, thanks very much.
Sure.
And, Lucian, let me just say hello. We met a couple of years ago at a Harvard Macy program, so it's good to hear your voice on the radio.
How are you?
What's on your mind, Steve?
Well, the reason I'm calling... You had asked the question, what can patients do in the face of all this? And I think just by way of background, I teach at the Harvard Business School where a fair amount of my research is around patient safety. And to Lucian's point, it's not that individuals kill patients. It's that systems cause well-meaning people and well-trained people to kill patients. And the point I want to make here is that a lot of these systems in which people work are constructed, and not out of intent, but constructed in such a way that oftentimes they can't help but make a mistake, is the first point. I'll give you a quick example. There was a journal article about a year or so ago talking about this poor lady, Mrs. Grant. She's recovering from surgery in the hospital. All of a sudden, she starts having a seizure. The nurses quickly draw blood, run that to the laboratory, run her up to get a scan and see what neurologically is going wrong.
Yeah.
Turns out nothing's going wrong. They get her back to the nursing unit. Blood results come back, and it turns out Mrs. Grant is severely hypoglycemic. What that means is she's got, like, hardly any blood sugar. They administer dextrose to get the blood sugar up. Doesn't work. She slips into a coma. Family withdraws life support on a 68-year-old lady who is otherwise well recovering from her surgery.
And who expected to leave the hospital hale and hearty soon, and instead she's dead.
Exactly, exactly. And you say, well, how could such a horrible thing have happened? And so the hospital... You know, they're doing this investigation, and really credit to them for both doing the investigation and then discussing it so publicly. What they found is as they're cleaning up, they found this multi-dose vial of insulin, which suppresses blood sugar. And they're thinking to themselves, well, what the heck is going on here? Mrs. Grant wasn't diabetic or didn't need insulin for any other reason. And so they're starting to work through, and it turned out, like at 6:45 that morning, it turned out Mrs. Grant had what's called an arterial line. It's basically a tube that goes into the body so doctors can very quickly give medication when needed.
And the wrong stuff went in.
You got it. She had a clot forming in that line. A nurse went to give heparin, which is an anticoagulant.
We're almost out of time. We can imagine the rest. Steve, thanks for your call. Greg Meyer, you deal with 1,200 doctors. Is this a familiar-sounding story?
This is a story, I think, that really rings true in terms of the challenges that we face in safety, but it also tells us a little bit about the things that are going on to try to improve it. And so there are many steps that we can take, putting in systems to do order entry so that the computer can help us make the right decisions, to keep track of patients by things like barcoding and making sure that just as when you bring your groceries up to the grocery counter that you know that you're paying the right price, we should be able to apply those kind of principles to healthcare to make sure the right drug goes to the right patient at the right time. Those are things that we're working on. I think we're making some progress on them. Is it as safe as we need it to be? Not yet.
Not close. Even if Lucian Leap's number of 95,000 is about right, 95,000 a year dead from hospital error. Lucian Leap, Greg Meyer, please stand by. We're looking tonight at allegations of an epidemic of deadly mistakes in America's centers of health care. Got to look at medical malpractice as well. It's a campaign issue. What about malpractice suits? Dick Cheney says it's time to cap awards at $250,000. If your child or spouse died in hospital by mistake, would that be enough? Would that be right? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking tonight about death by hospital error and allegations of an epidemic of deadly mistakes in America's centers of health care. You can join the conversation tonight. Does an epidemic of hospital errors square with your expectations of what happens beyond that admissions desk? Have you come home with a clamp sewn up with your liver with a harrowing story of an unnecessary near-death experience? And what will it take to ensure a reasonable margin of error in the nation's hospitals? We've been joined tonight by Lucian Leap, Dr. Lucian Leap. He co-authored a 1999 report for the Institute of Medicine estimating that roughly 95,000 patients die each year due to hospital error. We're also joined tonight by Dr. Greg Meyer, medical director of the Massachusetts General Physicians Organization, the largest physicians group in New England, over 1,200 members. We've got more guests coming on, but first, let's hear from the president of the United States today speaking on a related issue at LeClaire Park in Davenport, Iowa.
You cannot be pro-patient and pro-doctor and pro-trial lawyer at the same time. You have to choose. My opponent made his choice, and he put him on the ticket. I've made my choice. I will continue to work with Congress to pass medical liability reform for the patients of America.
President George Bush today taking aim at trial lawyer and vice presidential candidate John Edwards and referring to the GOP effort to cap medical malpractice settlements. We're joined now from Oak Brook, Illinois, by Dr. Dennis O'Leary. He's president of the Joint Commission on Accrediting of Healthcare Organizations. It's a big force in advancing patient safety, addressing public policy issues around healthcare. He served as dean for clinical affairs at the George Washington University Medical Center. Good evening and welcome, Dr. Dennis O'Leary.
Good to be with you.
Thank you so much for joining us. So you hear the big numbers, whether it's 200,000 or 95,000 or 100,000, and some of the debate tonight over how to deal with that. As citizens prepare to vote this fall, it would seem to intersect with the debate over how to handle medical malpractice. Dick Cheney on the stump saying it should be capped at $250,000. If we've got something like Lucian Leap's number of 95,000 deaths by error a year in hospital, does it make sense to be capping medical malpractice payouts? Don't we need some kind of cudgel held over hospitals to keep them worried about this?
Well, there's no evidence that holding cudgels over hospitals or over physicians solves patient safety problems. In fact, probably no more than 3% of cases where there were errors leading to egregious injuries even end up in the courts, and many of these cases are thrown out or settled in favor of physicians or hospitals. We do have a serious patient safety problem. We also have a serious tort problem that's driving premiums out of sight, causing doctors to move or leave practice, and now creating not only a patient safety problem but an access problem. Both issues need attention. The capping of damages will put some limitation upon the premium expenditures, but that doesn't really get at the basic problem that the current tort system puts a major chill on reporting and identifying occurrences so that we can learn from them and solve problems. We have operated a voluntary reporting database of unanticipated deaths and permanent loss of function for the last 7 years, and we receive probably about 0.1% of what's out there. And it is universally believed that the reason we don't receive these reports is because of the worry that these will be discovered by trial lawyers. If we don't know what's out there, we can't learn and take steps to improve.
We've got callers who want to speak to exactly that point. Dr. O'Leary, stand by. Deborah's on the line. Hi, Deborah. You're on the air.
Yeah, thank you. I'm actually a physician, and I just wanted to reiterate that I do believe that there are terrible and egregious errors that are occurring. I, for one, have had to basically prevent my own death in a hospital that is in the metropolitan area of Boston, that is a huge and also an academic teaching institution.
And you're a doctor, and you believe you were nearly killed there.
I have had to prevent my own death from staff not being savvy and actually just doing their normal checking that they ought to be doing. And I'll just quickly tell you, you know, the incidents, and then you can, address
it. Let's hear it. Let's hear it.
One episode was that I had a malignant melanoma, which is a cancer which will produce death if it's not properly taken care of. And I had it removed. The path department of this hospital incorrectly staged this. I looked at the path report, and because I was a physician, I knew that it was incorrectly staged. I took my slides and went down to the Brigham and Women's, And in fact, they staged it and they said there's still cells left in your arm, and I had to have a huge surgery to remove the remainder of the cell.
And of course, the percentage of patients who are able to do that is the percentage of patients able to do that is minute. Deborah, let me ask you.
But that was an egregious error.
Let me ask you. Do you think that doctors are aware this is going on, or is it just under the radar? They don't even know it's happening.
I think that even when it happens, they sweep it under the rug. The other thing that happened was I had surgery, a basic knee surgery, and I'm allergic to morphine. This was clearly printed on my preoperative chart. When I woke up, I had been given 7 doses of morphine. I was in a terrible allergic state. I had hives. I was scratching myself to pieces. There was blood on the sheet. The nurses didn't even pick this up. It was 2 friends who visited me about 5 hours later who found me in the sorry state, and they went to alert the nurses who, said, oh, my God, who gave her 7 doses of morphine? And
there we are, two scary stories from a doctor in the hospital. Deborah, thanks for your call. Lucian Leap, are these the kind of incidents that lead to death by error in American hospitals?
Yes, and they are the kind of incidents that sometimes lead to malpractice suits. But as Dr. O'Leary said, malpractice suits aren't the answer. The tort system doesn't really identify the great majority of that small percentage of doctors who are negligent, and it doesn't compensate most of the patients. In fact, only a very tiny percent of patients who have injuries. If we want to deal with the problem of medical injuries in terms of fairness to the patient, what we really need is a compensation plan that countries like New Zealand and Sweden and some others have, in which patients are paid when they have costs from their injuries, and they don't have to sue the doctor to get it.
You mean, in other words, a government payout would go to families who lost a family member due to error in
the
hospital?
No, it would be the hospital. The hospital would pay the cost of your injury. So if you have a complication and you're out of work for 2 months, the hospital pays for your lost wages.
And how do they pay for death?
You insure for that like you insure for anything else. But the point is, if you compensated people for it, they would be much less likely to sue. But more importantly, we would be meeting our responsibility to pay for the consequences of our treatment.
Greg Meyer, what is going on in hospitals that gets these big numbers out there? We read that people saying the hospitals are becoming less safe, not more, that the explosion in the number of drug choices is so great, that there's such complex systems at work. Why is this happening?
Yeah, I think to some extent you just answered part of the question there, and that is it's the complexity of all the care that we provide. With that said, I am much more optimistic about this than you just implied in terms of, I think that things are actually getting better, and I think that there are some real opportunities for us to leverage things. For example, your caller just talked about an allergy. If, in fact, there was a computerized system that automatically alerted the physician ordering that morphine that said this patient had an allergy, even going to the point potentially of even stopping them from filling that order, that is something that wouldn't happen. That's something that we can do now, and that's the kind of system that we are investing in, and this is the kind of thing that I think is going to make patients safer over the longer run. I think the other point I think to recognize here is that this is work that will take time. You look at aviation, you look at manufacturing, what you'll see is that when they saw that they had safety problems, when they woke up to it and they began the discussion, they initiated what was a long and sustained effort. This isn't something we're going to fix overnight. Boy, I wish we could do that, and we're going to be working hard at it. But with that said, this is something that we're going to have our feet to the fire. I think that holding the cudgel over hospitals and physicians with torts is something that's been tried for 50 years. That's not been enough. But I do think that the general awareness that this is a huge problem and being able to talk about it and share our experiences, and one of the things that Dr. Leap just mentioned is the fact that we need to be able to discuss these close calls and these incidents that happen to patients in an open way so that we can make sure that what happened at one hospital that almost hurt a patient today doesn't kill a hospital tomorrow. Right now, there are barriers to that kind of discussion. There are barriers to that openness, and part of that is the medical malpractice climate. And until we solve that problem, I don't think that we're going to be able to make the leaps and bounds that are potentially out there for us.
Dennis O'Leary, what percentage of hospitals now have the kind of fail-safe systems that Greg Meyer's describing here? Is that still pie in the sky somewhere down the road? Is it being implemented now?
Well, we actually have a series of requirements. We're going to be talking about gradations over time, but having something as basic as forbidding the use of free-flow infusion pumps, forbidding the use of certain types of abbreviations, if you mesh that with bad handwriting, lead to the nurse reading the medication in the wrong way, marking surgical sites.
In other words, which leg is coming off? Or where's the incision to be?
Exactly. I mean, there are some very simple, low-cost things that you can do. We're raising the ante on things next year. There'll be requirements to reconcile medications when a patient moves from one unit to another, make sure that they're getting the same medications there as they were in the first place.
But are these widespread now or still or just being adopted?
No, yes, these efforts are widespread now. But the problem that we're dealing with is that this is a moving target. I would be almost certain that the problems that made up the numbers in the 1999 IOM report is not the same content anymore. We have made a lot of progress in addressing issues, but we're not gaining ground. And the reason is that we're introducing new drugs, new procedures, new techniques, new prostheses every day. And when these new things come out, no one has paid attention to the safety risks that are inherent in those.
And they come right back, and we still have the deaths. Robert's calling from Arlington, Massachusetts. Hi, Robert. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I'm with Pathfinders for Quality Care. We're the people who are organizing the Million Cadaver March on Washington.
Oh, gross.
To bring some more public attention to this issue. There are two approaches, really. One, which is extremely reasonable and extremely successful, is the one being pursued by our homegrown Institute for Healthcare Reform, which is located in Boston. Their website is ihi.org.
Robert, what's your basic critique?
Well, the squeeze essentially has come from the corporate boards who squeeze the HMOs, who in turn squeeze the hospitals, who reduce the nursing staffing, and all down the line. But the real critique is simply a lot of systems are using 19th century systems. Industry in the United States, with the exception of the healthcare industry, is using 21st century management systems. And as a management consultant, I can tell you that when IHI gets in there and makes these system-wide improvements, dramatic changes take place almost immediately.
But they're not happening widely enough, Robert. Thanks for your call. Lucian Leap, how about it? The core critique here being that we've got a systemic problem. The squeeze is coming from the structure of American healthcare. It's a profit margin issue. Do you buy that?
I think there's a lot to that. We not only have made healthcare incredibly complicated, we continue to add to that. It's called progress. What we've done is we haven't managed it very well. But let me say there's one fairly simple and yet very complicated answer to this, and that is the time has long passed for the United States to implement a computerized patient record. Britain did it 10 years ago. We need to have all patients' records on the computer in the hospital, in the doctor's office. It seems like a no-brainer. We've been talking about it for 40 years.
What are the politics of that? I've heard
the
opposition.
Politics have to do with money. The administration is proposing to spend $50 million in the next year or two to facilitate computerization of patient records in rural doctor's offices. That figure is off by three zeros. It should be $50 billion over about 3 or 4 years.
Is it worth it?
There's no question it's worth it. Now, healthcare spending over that 3 years will be about $5 trillion. So we're talking about spending 1% of what we now spend in order to computerize healthcare, to get all the information in the computer, to have computerized ordering, to be able to access data, to be able to analyze it, to be checking automatically for when people develop new complications of drugs.
Bush administration says no, too expensive. What does Kerry say? Do you know?
I haven't heard him on this. But I think it's an issue that the time has really come. The technology is all there, but it's not going to happen unless it's a federal policy and that it's funded. And we certainly can afford to do it, and it would make a huge difference. It would make a tremendous difference in our ability to manage a very complicated system.
Well, with that, we're out of time, but that may be the very expensive but maybe appropriate way to staunch the bleeding, the hospital deaths. Lucian Leap, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
Dr. Lucian Leap, adjunct professor of health policy at Harvard School of Public Health, and Greg Meyer at the Massachusetts General Physicians Organization. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you as well.
And Dr. Dennis O'Leary, president of the Joint Commission on Accrediting of Healthcare Organizations in Oak Brook, Illinois. Thanks a lot for joining us.
You're welcome.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.